Here's what we'll do, Ken. I'll do this in a robot voice. Listener, you would go to...
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick, and I'm in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke in Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
Not too bad, Gabe. How are you? You're out of the tiki room and into the office.
Out of the tiki hut and into the office, but that's okay, Ken, because it's going to be wing night here on the archaeology podcast.
Oh, yeah,
we're going
right.
to talk
yeah.
about great off. Yeah.
I'm getting the joke now. That's
yeah.
I just about
as you can tell, listener, Ken and I have prepped extensively for this introduction we're doing now, and I don't know about you, Ken, but the other thing about this is I have stepped almost entirely outside of time because we're pre-recording some episodes here, with some evergreen content that we're going to drop throughout the summer here. So we've been doing a bunch of interviews,
we're not just pre-recording the content; we're post-recording the intro to that pre-recorded content.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah.
What a way to run a railroad, right? But listener, this is you've done it again. You've wasted another perfectly good season of your life listening to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, because Ken, this is the season two finale.
It is the season two finale. Yes, we are. As you listen to this, we will be followed by a few weeks of silence from the NB Arc Pod before we start up season three. So I don't think we'll end on a cliffhanger. It'll be like the Marvel movies. It'll say like Gabe and Ken will return, at some time in mid to late August, probably.
I think that's true. And I think actually, listener, we're going to be pretty close to our fortnightly schedule. We're not going to fall too far away from you before we come back. But if we're a little bit late, it's because, sometimes a finale takes a minute to recover from.
Exactly.
Yeah. So obviously we want to thank the listener. And one other thing I actually just wanted to make a note of here. I was out just yesterday, actually, visiting the University of Maine Archaeological Field School, and discovered that we've got a number of UMaine Field School listeners to the podcast. So we just wanted to welcome them to the program.
Yeah. And thank you for listening, UMaine Arc School Archaeological Field School listeners.
Yeah. We really appreciate it. And thanks for touring me around the site you were working on the other day. It was nice to be back. It's kind of cool, Ken. They're still working on basically the same landform I did my field school on, still funded by the Maine Academic Prominence Initiative. So it's cool to be back out there. It was alumni day at the...
Very, very cool. So was this where you were like sorting gravel from a house floor site?
This is the very same, yes.
Yeah, This is where you cut your teeth. I believe you and Nadine were both on that field school. Is that right?
No. Nadine was not. Just me. But the
okay.
Well, me and 11 other UMaine students. But the,
it was a lonely. No. It was a quiet field school that year.
What was quiet was late evenings counting gravel in the basement of South Stevens Hall for a semester, which isn't exactly. It wasn't exactly. It's not as interesting as the. I enjoyed it a lot, and I thought it was pretty interesting. But I think the listener will find more interesting the undergraduate thesis we'll be talking about later in this program. But first, Ken, we are sponsored, as we've been all season. So special thanks for the full season sponsorship, I believe, here of the Association of Professional Archaeologists of New Brunswick. And most of the season, maybe all the season, from the ULEF Shirk Exchange Grant.
Yeah. So we want to shout out once again the Office of Research and Innovation Services at the University of Lethbridge, and appreciate their support of the program and enthusiasm they have, their engagement with the program and enthusiasm about it continuing and the financial support that allows us to do that.
That's right. And also the support they've had as we are pursuing other financial support.
Yeah, exactly.
To keep this program going and to keep Emmanuel fed and housed and all these kinds of things.
Exactly.
But Ken, one of the things that having this sort of generous sponsorship enables us to do is as we have been expanding our scope here, I mean, we're really actually even going interdisciplinary today on this podcast, but as we've been expanding the scope, you know, it seems like the name New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast is maybe just not conveying the sort of, you know, true interdisciplinarity, true regional expanse, the passion of our listeners, the degree to which we seamlessly merge discussion about archaeology with restaurant reviews. And one of the things that that means is we're sort of in the market for a new name for this podcast. And we wouldn't, we would, one of the things, Ken, I think we can agree is that that we're blessed with some of the best podcast listeners around. You know, the our podcast listeners are not just intelligent, they're friendly, they're generous, and we wouldn't want to take advantage of their generosity by just stealing a name they would provide for this podcast. I mean, it's much like, Ken, when you became famous for renaming the course Moodle at the University of Toronto. They didn't just steal that from you. They sent you like a hooded sweatshirt or something, didn't they?
And I almost got doxxed on Reddit to go with it. So
but that means, Ken, that we would like to, if the listener were to write in with a new name for this podcast and we accepted it, we'd like to give them a reward. But first, Ken, where would the lucky listener with the winning name for this podcast, where would they write to?
They would be writing to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And if we cracked open that mailbox and found the winning entry in there, what would the person who had submitted that win?
Well, so how's your productivity these days, Gabe?
Oh, it's terrible, Ken. It's not what it used to be.
Yeah, it can be, you know, pretty tough to keep focused in the dog days of the summer. Although you're wearing a shirt today, would you,
I was wearing a shirt last time. I'm just wearing more of a business shirt.
Well, I was going to say it has sleeves on it this time that are longer than, and a pattern that is less Hawaiian. So, you know, you're not the only one whose productivity, exploding topics cites it on average somewhere around 23% of the workforce is engaged at any time in their work.
And something like 23% is engaged?
Yeah, only 23% is engaged at work. And 21% of remote workers are actually reporting being burned out.
No kidding.
And so we all deserve a break. You know, I think I've got a few days that I'm taking off here coming up. I think you've got some holidays yourself. We sometimes don't have the luxury of taking these days off, though. And so that's why at the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, we've come up with something special for our listeners. And so, Gabe, are you familiar with large language models?
This is a ChatGPT and things like this, right?
Yeah. So these operate under the principle that through computationally intensive, self-supervised and semi-supervised training, artificial neural networks that your LLM is built on can become a generative artificial intelligence system. That is, if you teach a man to fish, he will inevitably tell you that glue is an integral part of a pizza recipe. Now, setting aside the very public problems with some of these models, so like Google's Gemini recently, or the issues with appropriation of intellectual property, our crack team at the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast has been hard at work with our partners at Chatbase in developing our own AI chatbot to serve all of your planning and productivity needs. And I'm going to share something with you right now, Gabe.
Okay. The listener can't see this, but Ken is just changed into a robot suit. And is,
so, Gabe,
is
Gabe, can you see what's on your screen right now?
It looks kind of like a phone and then kind of what looks like sort of one of those, or not really a phone, but one of those, like if you, you know, Amazon.com delivers your package to the wrong place and you have to chat with a customer service representative. It says,
exactly.
Hi,
and so
what can I help
much
you
like
with?
You'd approach a workout at a gym or eating healthy or when you're doing Bayesian statistics, garbage in makes garbage out. But when you mix the quality of NB ArcPod with the GPT-4o API, you can be assured of the highest quality custom chatbot to serve your needs. Yes, the power of GPT-4o, and O stands for Omni, a super intelligent AI assistant built in OpenAI's patented technology, makes a step towards a more natural human-computer interaction and a platform that can respond to audio inputs in as little as 232 milliseconds, which is similar to the human response in conversation. Using this,
it's like
bot,
a parsec and a half, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Using this bot, you will get responses to your most burning questions. Like, for example, what is the best episode of the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast? And you'll receive thoughtful answers, like choosing, quote, the best episode of the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast can be subjective and depends on your interests. Each episode offers unique insights into different aspects of archaeology in New Brunswick. Here are a few examples that might stand out based on various themes. Episode 1, Introduction to New Brunswick Archaeology. Episode 2, A Short History of New Brunswick Archaeology. Episodes featuring guest experts. Episodes on specific archaeological sites. Episodes on Indigenous archaeology. Ultimately, the, quote, best episode for you will depend on your specific interests within the field of archaeology. If you have a particular topic or theme you're interested in, I can help you find an episode that matches your interests. And while it does need a little bit of work, we are not Gabe Reiner and Ken Holy. We're training it daily to help you with all sorts of tasks to increase your work productivity up to 66%. No longer will you need to scroll endlessly to find that episode of the NBARC pod you've been desiring. Just ask the chatbot, and it will lead you down one of many potentially factual paths to the episode that you desire, shaving minutes off your day and freeing you up to complete the necessary task you're avoiding by listening to this podcast. Now, the lucky listener will wonder, what's the prize? Well, we are offering an early access pass to this chatbot. Not only will you get the luxury of additional leisure time, but you'll relish in the ability to reign over the teaching of an artificial intelligence that one day will serve as your master. So if you're burdened by HAL 9000 of the tasks that you need to undertake today, and you're looking for the Ultron opportunity to be the Terminator of your to-dos, be a brainiac. Give yourself the max headroom in life and kit yourself out with the master control program of your dreams by renaming the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
Wow, Ken, that is good. And I think our listener is going to have a whole new efficiency. And so where would they, if they have that winning title, where would they yell at their Alexa to tell their ChatGPT to open up, to tell your ChatGPT to open up our mailbox?
So let's try this out right now. Where would I email to reach the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast?
Okay, he's typing it in, listener. Uh-oh.
I have reached my message limit. It appears that we have maxed out our free language model questions at this time.
That is fascinating. What else have you been using this for, Ken, dare I ask?
So I input a couple of our transcripts into it to teach it about the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast and got some kind of funny answers. So,
well, here's what we'll do, Ken. I'll do this in a robot voice. And listener, you would go to.
NewBrunswickArchaeology@gmail.com. That is New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. NewBrunswickArchaeology@gmail.com. And as we always forget, we also have a website that you can visit, which is just NewBrunswickArchaeology.com, all one word, spelled exactly the same way as the email address. And you can find all of your NB ArcPod needs at that website.
That's right. And we'll turn off the glitching robot, so you'll be perfectly safe to go to that website. And we're planning on, it's probably important that you periodically check that website, listener. Like, if you could go there 30 or 40 times a day to support search engine optimization, or if you have a large language learning model that would be willing to just keep hitting the refresh button, we would appreciate that. So Ken, if you go to our, I don't know if we'll have any mail, but do we have any mail in there?
We don't have any mail. And so although we're appearing, this episode is appearing in a couple of fortnights, we've been checking the mail fairly frequently lately, and as a result, the mailbag has not filled back up. So maybe we'll be greeted by a whole bunch of mail when we come back from the break.
That's right, and we can't wait. You know, listener, we always love to hear from you. So Ken, we are going to be joined this fortnight by Lucia Snyderman, which is very exciting. And she's going to talk to us about great auk extinctions to wrap up this season. We're really looking forward to that. In fact, listener, we can tell you, we already found it quite interesting because we've stepped outside of time. And so, Ken, but before we get to that, is there anything we want to tell the listener about next season?
I think that we've got some interesting, we'll continue doing interviews with interesting people on interesting topics. But I think that the overall theme that we had talked about is looking at more of these human environment interactions, and probably getting out to a couple more conferences and meeting a wider range of individuals. And if you have ideas or topics or sites, for example, that you want to learn a little bit more about, we would welcome emails. And if you know of somebody that you think should be on the show or whose work that you're familiar with or read recently, we would be more than happy to entertain new subjects. And if you are a listener and you want your research to be highlighted, we're happy to meet you and talk about what you're working on.
We certainly are. And Ken, where would they send that suggestion for a new show?
NewBrunswickArchaeology@gmail.com. That's all one word. New Brunswick Archaeology. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY.
All right. Thank you very much, Ken. So we are joined this fortnight by Lucia Snyderman to talk great auk. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Not just any auk, not even just a good auk, a great auk. Pittsburgh Pirates to invoke Lucia's hometown, maybe below 500, but the auk she's going to talk about might win 110 games this season. Lucia just graduated with a degree in biology from Middlebury College, where among other honors, she received a Goldwater Scholarship to do research at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Back at Middlebury, her thesis was on the spatiotemporal extinction dynamics of the great auk, and that was as part of an NSF-funded project in Alexis Mikhailo's lab. Lucia is off to do a PhD next at the Zoological Society of London and the University of Reading to expand upon the work she's going to tell us about today. Lucia is currently preparing the work she's going to tell us about today for publication. We understand it's going out into the world in a week or two, and she will let the listener know when that paper is ready, and we'll post that in a future show notes. And I was particularly fortunate to meet Lucia at a lecture she gave at the University of New England in Biddeford this summer. Welcome to the Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, Lucia.
Welcome to the NBARC Pod.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm excited to talk auk with you all.
That's great. And so actually, we wondered if you could just start by telling us a little bit about the great auk in terms of its biology, you know, what it is, how come we don't have it available in the grocery store now? These kinds of questions.
Questions. So what even was the great auk? Well, the great auk is no longer here. It is an extinct seabird that disappeared from coasts across the North Atlantic sometime in the mid-1800s. And it was a very large flightless seabird. In fact, it was North America's only flightless seabird. So I think that is really exciting. We also know that the great auk had many different names across its range to many different cultures. So some of my personal favorite are penguin. So when you're looking in historical archives, you have to look for these different names to understand what species is being referred to. And penguin was actually the great auk. In fact, the name penguin was later transferred to the penguins we know today.
Oh, interesting.
So they were the original penguins?
They were, yes. Oh,
cool. That, they didn't. I don't remember Morgan Freeman mentioning that in the documentary, but it's been a while.
Yeah.
It's the truth, though. The reason they look so much like a penguin is because of convergent evolution. So they have all these marine adaptations because they were diving for fish like sculpin and lump sucker. And because of that, they have similar adaptations to the penguins we know today. But despite that, they are not at all closely related genetically to the penguins we know today. Their closest relative is actually the razorbill or Alca torta, or you might be more familiar with the puffin. And so <Okay. laughs> the puffin is a cousin of the great auk.
Yeah, the pictures or the drawings that I've seen of it, it looks like basically a very large puffin, but with a much more robust beak, basically. Yeah. So you had mentioned how big they are. So how big did these birds get?
they were pretty large. I would say they were about a couple feet, close to like 11 pounds. But they had tiny, comically tiny wings, which were useful for wing-propelled diving. And this is just a funny fact that kind of weaves into that, but when taxidermists were trying to sell great auks, some of them just didn't have great auks, so they would put razor bill wings on other large birds to make them look like a great auk and try to pass those off.
That's interesting. So somewhere there are presumably mislabeled taxidermied specimens in probably in your cigar club, Ken, when you go in there and your Thomas Jefferson themed cigar club. Yeah,
exactly. Probably right beside the mummy hands too. That's
So, and you mentioned their range, which is distinct, I gather, from what we know as penguins today. And what was their range, more or less?
So their range, if we're talking about the past 10,000 years, which is the Holocene, they were all across the North Atlantic. So the most southerly occurrence was actually in Florida, which is a bit of an oddball. And we think that the reason they may have gotten down there was just because of weird weather patterns. But their range is mostly concentrated in Iceland, Europe, and definitely Canada. And they were also in the Gulf of Maine. We know for certain that they were breeding at Eldey Island, Iceland. Before that, they were breeding at Geirfuglasker, Iceland. Geirfugla means great auk in Icelandic. But that breeding...
Gabe, did you write down that spelling quickly?
I actually speak Icelandic, Ken. That's no problem. I'll be able to catch us up at the end.
And that breeding colony disappeared because of a volcanic eruption. So that was a proximate cause of extinction. But they bred in Iceland. Their main breeding colony was actually Funk Island. You might be able to guess what Funk was referring to. It was because the birds smelled so bad on that island. And there are quotes of people who went on that island and said they could not fit a boot between all these birds, all these fowls. Oh, wow. And so they bred there as well. They also bred at St. Kilda, Scotland, which was an interesting community of people who lived off of seabirds, actually. I read online that they would eat 20 eggs a day. And so I would imagine they were definitely eating great auk too. Yes. So we know the great auk was on islands and coastlines and low rocky shelves where it could easily hop on, as it could not fly.
Yeah. Were they migratory? Like, did they come in and out of the region, or were they here the year round?
So we still are not sure exactly what their migration patterns look like, but work has been done by Jessica Thomas, who looked at ocean circulation patterns. And so one big question I'm interested in exploring, as well as other people, is were they breeding in the Gulf of Maine? And where were they migrating? So we really don't know, but I imagine they swam further south. And we can also get a sense of this by looking at the shell middens or archaeological sites where they were found, if we know seasonality information.
Okay, interesting.
That is a beautiful transition.
Yeah.
That's like a...
Should I pause here before I go to the next question, Ken, just to savor the way that was set up? Thank you, Lucia.
Exactly.
And this is that your research group has compiled the first comprehensive database of all existing radiocarbon dates and sighting dates for the great auk across its entire North Atlantic range, which is really, really cool. Could you just tell us a little bit, how did you do that?
So it really involved reading a lot. I love to read, so that was no issue. And what was really fun was requesting and getting my hands on some really old books, including captain sea journals from centuries ago. And so I would say that interlibrary loans are a great resource, and historical archives are really treasure troves of information. And so what I did is I just started reading as much as I could about the Great Auk. And I mentioned earlier, I had to learn all the names for the Great Auk because it wasn't always called the Great Auk. And so I began to search for it under these many names. I have a table I made. I believe it's up to about 100 different names and spelling variations now. So that was how I went about that. And regarding compiling radiocarbon dates, I also had to become comfortable reading archaeological literature, and very few Great Auks have been directly radiocarbon dated. So I had to look at where they were in the different layers or strata of Shelmiddan sites and see what had been dated in the same layer, what was associated with the Great Auk bone that was in that layer, and then see if that was dated. So I also compiled all associated dates that I could find, and those were radiocarbon dates.
So can you give us a bit of a sense of kind of the temporal and geographic distribution archaeologically of Great Auk? This is really fascinating. I was saying to Gabe before we came on that I was flipping through the Turner Farm Faunal Report because I figured at least there'd be at least one reference to Great Auk at Turner Farm. But I'm guessing that you've come across many different ones that probably most people aren't familiar with.
One part of it actually was I did learn how to identify Great Auk bones. So I think an important note is that sometimes Great Auk bones aren't even recorded, or just people weren't looking for them or didn't identify them. So I believe that there are many more Great Auk bones throughout the Gulf of Maine and beyond that just haven't been looked through with all the other zoo archaeological information.
Yeah, I think I told you this in the field, Lucia, but when I was an undergraduate, I was taking Brian Robinson's methods course, and he, I think to stump me, handed me a shoebox of Great Auk that I was supposed to identify, which I did not successfully identify.
Well, it is a very big bone. I mean, very big bird bones, definitely.
Yes. Yeah.
And so once you know what you're looking for, you know what it is.
Okay, great. So where and when did you find it? Just a like kind of an overview.
Yeah, so to get back to your question, so I was looking at the Holocene, so over the past 10,000 years, but the archaeological sites, or the majority of the archaeological sites, probably span several hundred years, 2,000 years in the past, and I have not noticed any patterns really yet relating to abundance of auk bones through these sites, but that is something we were looking for. Another question we had, is there a change in size perhaps? Did people harvest the larger individuals first? But that can be hard to look at sometimes when there's stratigraphic mixing at these sites, which is quite common sometimes. And so you don't really know exactly what time these bones are from. So that was a challenge.
Great. And sort of culturally, I guess we're, like you mentioned, like so the Bayothic are eating Great Auk, Wabanaki peoples are eating Great Auk, people in Iceland and Scotland even earlier in the Holocene are eating Great Auk. Is that sort of the summary? Are Paleo-Inuit peoples eating Great Auk too? Do we know?
We know that many different people ate the Great Auk. Definitely Inuit, yes. In fact, There are a few Inuit Great Auk legends that I'm happy to talk about. But
we
know that people were eating them because there are cut marks on the bones. And so I've seen some of those, and they've also been described in some of the literature. But what's interesting is that while people were eating Great Auks for a while, what really hastened and drove their extinction was the feather trade, which peaked in the 1700s. So the first auks were killed often by sometimes sailors just coming ashore. They were starving, and so they ate what was there and somehow developed a liking for the great auk. It was described as quite fishy and oily tasting. And people also ate their eggs. The Beotuk made a pudding from their eggs. So I wonder what that tasted like. But yeah.
You do not have a recipe we can put in the show notes, I gather. There's not a...
Yeah. We do like food suggestions, so if you're able to time travel and go back and get some great auk pudding...
It could be great auk flip, to return to a show from a few...
That's right.
From a few fortnights ago, yeah. So you mentioned... I definitely want to return to legends, because I understand sort of... many of these different groups have legends about these, as you just mentioned. But what exactly was the feather trade? What was going on with that?
So the feather trade really took off in Europe by the 1600s to 1700s. And so people were killing a lot of birds just for the sole sake of their feathers. Sometimes those feathers were put on women's hats or stuffed into mattresses. And the great auk was one of the avian victims. And what's interesting is that the feather trade then expanded over to North America. And so the first bird that actually experienced a large decline due to the feather trade was the eider. And so because eiders declined so much, Europeans switched over to the great auk, and then the great auk went extinct quite rapidly.
So that was my kind of follow-up, was that it had nothing to do really with like specifically the great auk feathers that were of, you know, high quality or anything. It was just that they were a readily available bird that was not going to fly away when you went to go collect it, basically.
Exactly. You could say they were awkward on land. So
I was trying to find an opportunity to throw that pun in there, but I am so glad that you did.
I had to. But you're entirely correct. They were quite easy to capture on land. They were great swimmers, but on land they were easily harvested.
Okay. And so what sort of legends did people have about these? I'm guessing that, you know, a large, ugly, flightless bird with tiny wings that swims really fast attracts some pretty strange stories.
Yes, it definitely does. I'll start with the first story I learned that also might be my favorite, but there is this one story that the last great auk may have been killed off Scotland, not Iceland, specifically St. Kilda, Scotland. And so the story is that three Scottish fishermen went out on their boats and they came across a great auk swimming, and for some reason they decided to tie it up on their boats. And then a big storm arose where they nearly drowned. And so naturally, I guess, they blamed the great auk and declared it a storm-causing witch. And so then they beat the great auk to death with sticks. And that is one story. I also do want to mention, though, that one of the descendants of the men who killed that great auk actually released a Gerfowl album, and I love it. And it's folksy music to commemorate the great auk and their family's history of the great.
Oh, wow.
If you could,
we'll have to get the link to that to that recording, because I think that would be a lovely piece to accompany the in the show.
Yes, notes, so. I also liked how generous you were in saying for some reason it certainly didn't have anything to do with that liquid product that Scotland is known for exporting.
So alongside some oral histories, there's also some really interesting archaeological patterning. So the you've got a blog post that you talk about how. There's actually, I believe it's a burial from a Beothic burial where there's an individual that was buried with over 150 upper mandibles of auk. And so do you want to talk a little bit about that? Like, what, you know, on the there's the story about this, the sea witch, but there's also, it's obviously very important in indigenous groups as well.
Yes, definitely. So when I came across that information about the Portoshaw burial site of the Beotuk, I was definitely interested to learn that there were about 200 great auk mandibles in, or beaks, in one grave. And the belief is that all those auk beaks may have been buried with that person because they once constituted a cloak and may have reflected fishing success of that person in life. And
wow.
In another grave there, a great auk effigy hairpin was also found. And so you can see there that the great auk was likely a revered animal to the Beotuk people. And there are also historical records showing how the arrival of European exploitative hunting dynamics impacted not only the great auk, but the Beotuk people, who had an important relationship to the species. And so Europeans would come and shoot the birds and also shoot at the Beotuk in their canoes. And I think it's important to think about how Europeans disrupted and changed that relationship between humans and birds in a devastating way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess, so you've told us a bit about your use of archaeological data and the reasons you sort of do this, and the and you mentioned beneficial preservation issues that Shelvins provide. But I wonder if you could also tell us a little bit, Ken, was that a great auk I just saw running into your office?
It's one of my two great auks.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. And I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit what sort of lessons we can take from these kinds of extinctions. And right. And so I guess in particular, though, what I'd maybe like you to start doing, I'm looping around on this question. First, why did the great auk actually go extinct, and when? Has your research been able to nail this down?
So, as I said, the feather trade does seem to be the primary driver. Before my work, Jessica Thomas did a population viability analysis, which can model and predict how different harvest rates culminated in extinction for the great auk. And under all her analysis scenarios, the great auk went extinct with a conservative harvesting estimate. And so this highlights that, yes, people were hunting great auks at very high rates, but also just because of the biology of the great auk and its life history traits, such as the fact that it only laid one egg a year, a breeding season, definitely made it more vulnerable to extinction. But humans were the cause. It was not climate change, for instance.
Yeah, so it's and it's like sort of coinciding with the Little Ice Age, which probably affected some of their habitat, but it was overpredation basically that was the real death knell.
So you made a good point there, bringing up the Little Ice Age. So genetic work has also been done by Jessica Thomas, and it found that they did experience a bottleneck, but that was a long time ago, and so the genetic data also shows that they had pretty much fully recovered from that before human harvesting at elevated rates began.
Okay, interesting. And humans were the primary predator for great auks? What, or were there other things that liked to eat?
Some people claim polar bears, and I'd say probably other large predatory birds as well.
Okay.
But things are pretty good for great auks, except for humans, essentially.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And so it seems like there's some lessons perhaps in this for the future, and maybe for thinking about seabirds in general. And what are some take-home points just for the listener or for other folks who maybe even not archaeologists, but what are the lessons from your research?
I think one of the lessons is that extinction doesn't happen all at once, right? It's a process. Range collapse happens with typically populations disappearing at the periphery first, and then you have that core range that may persist longer. But we really need to look to human-auk relationships to understand population persistence. So how did different groups of people interact with the auk? We've established that European settler colonists had a different relationship, perhaps, compared to indigenous communities like the Inuit, the Beothuk, the Mi'kmaq. And so I think it's really valuable for a species like the great auk to consider how humans related to and interacted with the species for understanding its process of extinction. And that's increasingly relevant today. We see that seabirds are at an elevated risk of extinction today. And so we can learn from the great auk and conserve its cousins like the puffin, which is now declining in Maine due to a combination of factors. For instance, climate change is causing its prey to migrate further north. And so the puffins are not able to find enough of their main food source and satisfy their hungry chicks. And so the great auk is an excellent lesson to learn from. It's a sad tale of our failure, perhaps, to save the species, but the great auk was actually the first species where people started to realize that we could drive extinction. Extinctions are not purely natural. And so yeah. I think we can still take lessons from extinct species like the great auk and become better stewards of our planet for the future. And we need to bring together people from different communities, indigenous communities, scientists, archaeologists, current seabird biologists. The more perspectives, the more diverse perspectives we can bring in, can allow us to more robustly understand ecosystem change on temporal and spatial scales for conservation.
Wow. So that sounds a little bit like a maybe an upcoming PhD project. And and so you've finished one degree just recently, and you're getting some publications out, but you're moving on. So what is going to be this PhD project that's upcoming? Are you continuing to explore the depths of the great auk?
So I do love the great auk, and I will be pursuing a PhD at the Zoological Society of London, looking at wetland ecosystem change. So a bit different, but I will be meeting a new character, the Dalmatian pelican, which is the world's largest flightless bird, and it's classified as vulnerable across its range, but it disappeared from the United Kingdom millennia ago. We don't really know exactly when. And so this project is going to be looking at that bird as well as sturgeon species that have also disappeared from the UK to understand how the ecosystem there has changed, how have the wetlands changed, and could the Dalmatian pelican be reintroduced potentially? May climate change actually open up more suitable habitat for the species in the future? So those are some of the questions I'm going to be pursuing with stable isotope analysis. And regarding the great auk, I really want to go visit the Gerfowl books, which John Woolley wrote when he was hoping to find a great auk in Iceland in the 1860s, but showed up too late, unfortunately. But what he did was become kind of an anthropologist, and he interviewed all the people that had gone on great auk hunts from that time. And so
very cool.
Those notebooks are not digitized, so I'll have to go in person and read through them for some more great auk information.
That's very neat. So you're kind of doing like kind of like a subdiscipline. You're kind of doing, I guess, anthropological biology rather than biological anthropology, or sort of historical biology in a really fascinating way. Like this is kind of incredibly interesting research avenues that, you know, it has many complementarities to what like Gabe and I would do on a normal basis, but you have much more, robust scientific skills than I think that we do. So
it's like what we do, but real, Ken.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You can identify the great auk bones. We know that there's bird in there. That's
but you know more about the people, so that's important too.
Yeah, and as you said, it's important that we're talking to each other more. I think that's a good takeaway. So,
We should we're perhaps getting kind of close to our half finished bottle of Courvoisier. The listeners should know that we've interrupted Lucia actually on a research trip out at Isle of Shoals, where working with contemporary birds and with contemporary children is my understanding. And so, we appreciate Lucia coming on to share this information about the great auk, and we're very excited to see the publication, and so please send us that when it comes out. We'll include it in a future show note. And also, best of luck on your PhD. We hope you're sneaking in some fun before going overseas to do that.
Yeah, it'll be fun to have you back on for... Sorry, it was the Dalmatian...
Pelican.
Dalmatian Pelican. It'll be fun to have you on to talk about the Dalmatian Pelican.
The title for that one sort of writes itself, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much, Lucia. Was there anything else that you wanted to share? Like anything you want to pitch or highlight that we didn't get to?
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I would just say, don't be afraid to do what you love. And I think there's a lot to be gained from studying extinct species. Today I actually learned that living birds can be quite hard to study because they like to bite and poop on you. So I was grateful that I was not being attacked by a great auk.
Yeah, there are less hazards to an archival biology program, eh?
Yes, but yeah. I would just say that I think the magic happens when you are working across different disciplines and fields. And so I really love being a part of this interdisciplinary kind of research. And I think we need that holistic perspective to understand and learn from extinction.
That's a fantastic way to end. And thank you so much for coming on. This is really fascinating stuff. Like I love learning about, I'm going to be doing a lot more great auk research and kind of following this. So I look forward to seeing the paper when it comes out. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Lucia. All right. So we are still in the virtual studio with Lucia, and Ken and I realized that we committed a Hakuna errata here in a bit of a podcasting error, because we forgot to mention that Lucia had looked at great auk bones from site 506 in Biddeford, Maine, which we discussed, was it two fortnights ago, right, Ken?
Yes.
That's right. And can you tell us anything about those great auk bones off the top of your head, Lucia? We're putting you on the spot to describe a very specific bone from a very specific site, but we appreciate you playing along.
Yes, so it was exciting to learn that there were great auk bones there. And what I remember is that there were actually quite a few. There were a lot. So I remember noting how many of each bone element were found there, from what strata. And then I found the associated dates. But it was an exciting find because great auks were clearly abundant.
That's great. Cool. So listener, remember this. And plug this back in when you're reminiscing about Arthur's, if you're listening to them in order, when you're reminiscing about our show with Arthur, you know something else.
You've just learned something new. So thanks again, Lucia.
Thank you so much, Lucia. Well, Ken, I think we are on to our hit pieces. And our hit piece for this episode is we've got a new contribution by Tim Spahr that represents some of the work by the Cape Porpoise Archaeological Alliance. And so the citation here, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes, is the title is Island Archaeology in Cape Porpoise, Maine, by Tim Spahr. And it is in a new journal called Archaeology Now. And it is in issue number 2 of Archaeology Now in 2024. And this is the new journal by the folks over at the Eagle Hill Institute. And
yeah, and it looks like it's supported by Brixtor Museum and Kennebunkport Conservation Trust.
Yeah, I think they're the people that are paying for this particular article to be hosted open access, I think. And what Archaeology Now is it's a new journal, I'm just reading from their website here, that publishes peer-reviewed photo essays that provide significant, academically rigorous interim updates from ongoing excavations prior to the publication of a final research report or research papers, or provides overviews of isolated finds. So I think, Ken, you sort of just said this seems to be in the spirit of journals like the SAA Archaeological Record, which is trying to get information in an open access format out to the public and encourage people to publish stuff, which is great.
Yeah. I get the sense that I think that these sorts of journals are actually kind of targeting a real need, which is that sometimes you have stuff that is almost there, but not quite there, or that you've got a project that maybe has come out in a bunch of different papers, but there's not something kind of pulling everything together that's digestible for folks that, you know, like this is where you can start and kind of peel off all the bits and pieces. And I suspect this probably comes out relatively efficiently is the other thing, is that sometimes you just want to get something out that isn't, you know, a full kind of drill down on all of the data or one particular aspect of the data. It's just sort of an overview of everything that you're working on.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So what Tim does here is he reviews, you know, the last, I mean, we must be coming up on nearly a decade of Cape Porpoise Archaeological Association work. It's got canoes, it's got fish weirs, it's got survey, it's got empty shovel test pits. It's really got anything you could possibly want. And the photos are quite nice, set in, you know, a lovely coastal setting. And there's some good pictures of that canoe and of stratigraphic profiles. And I just wanted to highlight here Elizabeth Kelly, who's the illustrator that works with Tim there. She's been doing research lately on basically on archaeological illustrating, and in particular on appropriate ways to kind of represent what a site might have looked like in the past using illustration without going too far into wild speculation. And so Elizabeth's an incredibly talented artist, and her and I think having some of her art in this format is going to be quite nice.
Yeah. The image 11 of this article is a beautiful like line drawing of what looks to be probably the canoe site, I'm guessing.
Yes, I believe so. And so it's got the canoe site and some of the other sites sort of in the distance that are mentioned in the. In the article. So go ahead and check this out. I'm actually looking forward to seeing this this journal hopefully take off a little bit, you know, for some quick research updates, probably mostly many of them from the Northeast based on it being out of the Eagle Hill Institute.
Yeah. I've made note of it as a venue to maybe push out some of my stuff, actually.
Yes, indeed.
That is conducive to nice photographs and short essays. So
absolutely. A picture is worth a thousand words.
There you go. Yeah.
Yep. That's it.
Unlike a couple weeks ago when we talked about Arthur and the picture was, I mean, it was worth a thousand words, but it was confusing.
Yes, exactly. That's pictures for you.
I think that gets us to the end of the program.
I think it does. Been a fun season, listener. We'll be back with season 3 and more hit pieces, and we can't wait to talk to you then.
Yeah, thank you, listener, for tuning in. And remember, as we mentioned a couple weeks ago, we are on the drive towards 10,000 listens, and so season 3 might be when that happens. And we'll be thinking up an interesting and exciting prize that won't be just a prize read. There will be actually a prize with it. So
that's right.
Yeah.
assuming we get there, listener, but we got to get there.
Yeah, exactly. So when we touch base again, I'll have probably come back from the field. Gabe, you'll have been across the North Atlantic, to the other side of the North Atlantic.
That's right.
And it'll be late summer and lots of new stuff, I'm sure.
The magnolias will be in bloom here in Fredericton.
Is that true?
No, I don't think so. I just felt like you were painting such a nice image that I was going
to... Yeah, yeah. I'll be able to pick my tomatillos and my hot peppers, so I guess that's exciting.
Oh, that's great. It'll be salsa night at the playoff residence. Salsa season. Yeah. Not even salsa week.
No, it'll be salsa season. The peppers go for about a month here, so...
Excellent. I wonder if we should do a special short episode that's me interviewing you while you make salsa.
Well, yeah, you could do that, or when I'm making hot sauce, one of the two.
So we could do both.
Both labor intensive.
Yeah, we could.
Yeah. Actually, do you know what we could do? You know what I could do is, because we have those lovely New Brunswick Archaeology podcast stickers, the next batch of hot sauce could be a special edition New Brunswick Archaeology podcast hot sauce that we could send as a prize to listeners.
That's great. I think that's a fantastic idea. Is that, I think that's terrific.
It's a shelf stable hot sauce that I follow all of the, you know, very important rules for food
safety.
All
the very important rules he can't name right now, but yeah, they're all very important.
All the very important rules, the temperatures and sanitizing and everything like that, that you got to do. But it's a habanero lime hot sauce is essentially the recipe that I have. I've gotten the flavor right on. So
that's right. Cool. And I can actually attest, Ken makes a very good salsa and a very good hot sauce.
So yeah, so look forward to season 3 and the NB Arc Pod hot sauce.
That's right. All right, Ken, perhaps we should set the listener free. and listener, we really look forward to seeing you next season.
Yes, and thank you again. Have a lovely rest of the summer, listener, and talk to you soon, Gabe.
Talk to you soon, Ken. We'll be right back.